Hello everyone, my name is Gamma Galaxian, and welcome to the podcast version of Memory Card, The History of Video Games, which is a docu-series on my YouTube channel, Gamma Galaxian, and this is a more laid-back, conversational kind of series for the podcast. If you want a more clean-cut, edited version, I recommend you go watch the docuseries on my YouTube channel, but this is kind of something I wanted to have more of a conversational feel with you, the listener, as I kind of explore the history of video games. And so without further ado, let's jump right into it. Video games have become a staple in the lives of many across the world, but how does something like Pong become Marvel's Spider-Man 2? Well, that's what we aim to discover as we journey through the history of video games. From the very beginning, through the Golden Ages, the Dark Ages, through all of our favorite gaming consoles, through all of our favorite games, and through all the obscurity in video game history. Video game history is rich with interesting stories and even more interesting video games. My goal with this series is to touch on everything through video game history, and while still shining a light on the stories behind Mario, Sonic, Halo, God of War, Last of Us, and Spider-Man, we will also touch on all the things that you may not know about that still influenced video games. Video games have touched my life, and I have a huge amount of respect for history. So I decided to combine two of my passions into this docuseries. So welcome to Memory Card, the history of video games. And we begin right at the start, the very beginning of video games. The fascination with television technology began about April 30th, 1939, when visitors of the World's Fair in Queens, New York were mesmerized by screens showcasing President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who opened the fair. The 1939 New York World's Fair is both the entry point for the history of television and video games without really knowing it. This was also the first time United States president appeared on a television broadcast. Thomas T. Goldsmith Jr. was pioneering television technology during this time. While the screens were showcasing the president's broadcast were created by Goldsmith's boss, Alan B. Dumont. And although Dumont was an important figure on creating the foundation for television, this story is about Goldsmith. So Goldsmith was born in Greenville, South Carolina on January 9th, 1910, and he was building crystal radio sets as a teenager. Which, when I look back to what I was doing as a teenager, I was basically just playing video games, and so I think Goldsmith's got me way beat here. But he went on to graduate from Furman University in 1931 and received a PhD in physics from Cornell in 1936. At some point, he teamed up with Essel Ray Mann to create the first video game. So this is kind of where a lot of the subjectiveness comes in. There's a lot of debate about the first video game, like what counts as the first video game. I've even seen articles talking about debating what the first video game is. I consider that Goldsmith and Essel Ray Mann created the first video game, and we're going to talk about it here. In 1947, the first video game was created. Although it did not have a catchy name at all, the cathode ray tube amusement device is considered to be the first interactive electronic game. You've got that right. The first video game wasn't something cool or edgy. It was the cathode ray tube amusement device. Imagine that on like a PS5 box in Best Buy. It was created by Thomas T. Goldsmith Jr. and Essel Ray Mann using analog electronics and cathode ray tubes. So I'm going to try to explain exactly what a cathode ray tube is, because they pop up quite a bit in video game history. The thing is, though, what I have in my notes here, which thanks to Britannica for also explaining what cathode ray tubes are, it still doesn't quite make sense to my pea brain, but maybe it'll help with y'all. I don't know. We'll see. The cathode ray tube is described as a vacuum tube that produces images when its phosphorescent surface is struck by electron beams. They were originally used for oscilloscopes, which were used to display electrical signals and how they change over time. Engineers often used these to measure electrical phenomena to test, verify, and debug circuit designs. I don't really think that helped me at all, but hopefully it helps somebody listening to kind of understand what exactly those are. We'll kind of move on. The cathode ray tube amusement device is described as a game of skill in which a player sits or stands facing a cathode ray tube CRT video screen mounted in a cabinet. Goldsmith and Mann designed the game to resemble a World War II radar display, but with airplanes or some other targets painted onto a transparent overlay, since this invention preceded the era of computer graphics. So there was nothing to really be showcased on the screen, and you had to have your own transparent overlay to really kind of make your imagination work. Otherwise, it was just a dot on a screen. So the game works by a player turning a control knob to position the CRT beam on the screen, which appears as a dot. This dot represents a reticle and is used to hover over airplanes until it overlaps, and by pressing a button, the player fires at the airplane or other target that you've got on your overlay. If the hit lands, the CRT beam will defocus to simulate an explosion. So not only was this the first video game in my eyes, but to me it's also the first shooting game. I mean, you're shooting at targets. So I count that as the first shooting game as well. So we're going to move on to the next staple in video game history, which we have to go back to 1938 to tell the full story here and look at the life of Joseph Kates. Kates was 17 years old when Nazi Germany invaded his hometown of Vienna. Kates fled to Italy and hid from the Nazis on the floor of a Venice gondola. He would write to Popular Mechanics that the experience turned me from a boy into a man. After Kates escaped and was sent away from England to Canada, he had to stay in an internment camp per the policies at the time. And he studied for a high school equivalency exam that ranked him a top student on all of Quebec, sorry, Canada. After being released from the camp, he moved from Toronto and worked on radar and radio tubes, optical components for periscopes and gun sights. Eventually, he joined the University of Toronto's Mathematics and Physics program. Later on, Kates and Alfred Ratz led a team to build the University of Toronto electronic computer, and that leads us to what's going to be the next video game, Birdie the Brain. It was amongst the first computers in the world, and Kates would eventually invent the Aditron. Whoa. Oh, let's back up here. Aditron tube, which he said, quote, "It was designed especially to do a binary addition all in one tiny tube, replacing a network of 10 interconnected ordinary radio tubes. A very revolutionary development at the time," end quote. The Canadian National Exhibition was the birthplace for Birdie the Brain in 1950. The game was essentially a giant tic-tac-toe game, with the computer using binary notation to calculate its moves. It was said at the maximum difficulty, Birdie could not be beaten. When someone lost to Birdie, the screen would light up "Computer Brain Win" in what was essentially the first game over screen. Again, very subjective. I consider it to be the first game over screen. It's essentially saying you lost. But that's kind of crazy. Birdie could not be beaten on the maximum difficulty. And I think about all of the difficult games today. Like, you know, everyone says Dark Souls is a difficult game. But people can beat Dark Souls. According to this, nobody could beat Birdie. Which is kind of insane because it's tic-tac-toe. So, which I think it's saying you can maybe tie Birdie, but you couldn't beat Birdie at tic-tac-toe if it was on its maximum difficulty. It was just way too smart. I don't know, like, if today that maybe somebody with too much time on their hands could beat Birdie. I would be interested to see that. I don't know if there's some kind of emulation out there that you can actually play the game or not, but I'd be curious to see that. So Cates goes on to describe kind of what the public's response was to Birdie the Brain. We had long lineups from day one of both visitors wanting to play and visitors just wanting to gawk. So while Birdie the Brain was proving to be a difficult challenge in Canada, Nimrod was making its rounds in the United Kingdom. It was 1951, and the United Kingdom launched the Festival of Britain, and John Bennett proposed having a computer at the Exhibition of Science in the festival for the British computer company Ferranti. I believe I'm saying that correctly. This computer would be designed to play Nim, which is a parlor game where the goal is to be the last person to remove a match from a pile of matches. The idea for making a computer capable of doing this came from an electrical mechanical machine called Nimitron during the 1940 World's Fair in New York. The creation of Nimrod began on December 1, 1950 by Raymond Stewart Williams, who worked with Bennett's designs for the machine. It was April 12, 1951 that Nimrod was created. It was a 12-foot wide, 5-foot tall, and 9-foot deep beast of a machine. It made its public appearance on May 5th, 1951, and although the public didn't really seem to care about the science behind the machine, they were really invested in playing the game. Most of the public were quite happy to gawk at the flashing lights and be impressed, said Bennett. Which, it eerily echoes what Cates was describing about Birdie the Brain. Like, almost, not word for word, but pretty much on the same theme. So, in 1952, there was another tic-tac-toe game that was created by Alexander Sandy Douglas using another amazingly long name here, Electronic Delay Storage Automatic Calculator. Ugh, it takes my breath out saying all these long names for these things. It was created as a part of Douglas's thesis for the University of Cambridge on human-computer interactions. So it's kind of interesting how he was already studying on the interactions of humans and computers and went on to create this game to kind of go about explaining that interaction. The game was called OXO, or Knots and Crosses. So here is how the game is described by LifeWire. OXO is an electronic version of tic-tac-toe called Knots and Crosses in the UK. Similar to the first electronic game, the cathode ray tube amusement device in 1947, OXO's graphics were displayed on a cathode ray tube connected to what I'm going to call the EDSAC computer. The graphics consisted of large dots forming the crosshatches of the playing field as well as the O and X player graphics. The game pitted the player against the computer with the player as the X and the EDSAC as the O. Moves were made by the player selecting which square to occupy with an X by dialing its corresponding number via the EDSAC's telephone dial. The telephone dial was used as a keyboard to input numbers and directions into the computer. So based on what I saw for pictures and simulations of it, for those that have never seen an old telephone dial, it was one of those that you had to like spin to select the numbers and all that. I'm pretty young, I'm Gen Z. And yes, I have seen one of those phones that weren't in like some kind of museum or something. It was, somebody was actually still using one of those phones. It was insane. It wasn't until 1958 that the next documented video game was created. And you may know about this one. It's called Tennis for Two. And the reason why I say that is Tennis for Two, a lot of people will say, is the first video game. And I don't quite agree with that, because of what I've researched. But I can definitely see why. It kind of pops up a lot if you just Google search what is the first video game, and Tennis for Two will like pop up instantly. These other ones I had to dig for. So I don't think Tennis for Two is the first video game, but I can definitely see why a lot of people came to that conclusion. And you know, again, it's all subjective. So I mean, it's just my opinion that I think the really long name of cathode ray tube amusement device as the first video game. And, you know, I could definitely see how Tennis for Two could be argued that that's the first video game. But enough of that. Let's talk about Tennis for Two. It was October 18th, 1958, during the annual visitor days at the Brookhaven National Laboratory. Visitors waited in line eagerly to play the electronic tennis game, and it was created by nuclear physicist William Higginbotham. The idea for creating something so interactive was due to Higginbotham realizing how most science exhibits are the opposite of interactive or fun. So he pretty much thought, and he realized, how a lot of those science exhibits just are kind of boring. And he capitalized on it. It was a great opportunity to make a game like this, and it worked. So thus, he thought, quote, "It might liven up the place to have a game that people could play, and which would convey the message that our scientific endeavors have relevance for society." The Brookhaven National Laboratory describes Tennis for Two as this. Visitors playing Tennis for Two saw a two-dimensional side view of a tennis court on the oscilloscope screen, which used a cathode ray tube similar to a black and white television tube. The ball was a brightly lit moving dot, and it left trails as it bounced to alternating sides of the net. Players served and volleyed using controllers with buttons and rotating dials to control the angle of an invisible tennis racket swing. So you had to really use your imagination on a lot of these old video games, because they just lacked the technology to really generate the graphics. I mean, this is all they had at the time, but it's crazy how people were just so fascinated by that at that time. It's like, you know, when 3D graphics came around with like the 64, people were fascinated by that, and people always think, how can it get any better? How could it get any better? And it just continues to get better. I mean, I was thinking during the 360 days, like, how could it get better than this? And then now we have PS5 and it looks amazing. So Space War is the next juggernaut in the early history of video games, and it came about in 1962, created by Steve Russell using MIT's DC-PDP-1 minicomputer. It was created to... Hold on. It was made to create a simulation of a dogfight in space, like something you'd see in Star Wars. I had to take a second there. It's okay. So Space War was a two-player game which controlled spaceships that launched torpedoes at each other while circling the sun, which created a constant threat of being pulled into it thanks to gravity. So while watching footage of this, basically the sun sits in the middle and the two ships are kind of flying around, kind of like, imagine asteroids. If you know what asteroids looks like, that's basically Space War, if you don't know what Space War looks like. So it was amongst the most popular games across the world. It was also among the first coin-operated games that inspired Nolan Bushnell to try and replicate its success with computer space. And based on what I've read, computer space just did not do what Bushnell was intending it to do. It wasn't as successful. But if you know who Nolan Bushnell is, he would go on to make Pong. And that whole story is going to come later because Pong deserves its own episode completely. So, moving on, the 1960s then saw several different computer games being created, including 3D Tic-Tac-Toe, that was created by the International Business Machines Corporation, IBM. Then there was Marienbad, and this one's a weird one. There's not a lot of information about it online. I had to pull most of my info from Wikipedia, which I don't like to do, but I just couldn't really find much about it. So it's a 1962 Polish puzzle mainframe game created by Euro engineer Witold Podgorski, and I'm going to try and pronounce these names correctly. So I apologize if anyone from Poland or of Polish descent or speaks Polish gets offended by my pronunciations, but I'm going to try my best. I'm going to try my best. It was created for the Odra 1003, and it was a game based on NIM and was based on a discussion from the magazine. Here we go. Przekroj? I'll roll with that. Due to the variant of NIM in the 1961 film last year at Marienbad. So, from a certain point of view, you could say that this was the first video game based on a movie. And I'm indifferent about that point, because it's basically another NIM game like Nimrod. But it's also named after the movie, essentially. And basically, the history of it was made for that purpose, to be based off of the movie. So, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. Let me know kind of what you think if that should count as the first game based off a movie. It would definitely be interesting. I guess it's a very subjective thing, but maybe it is. And that's fascinating that it wasn't a American movie that was the first game to be based off of. It was Poland. Poland made the first one. I think that's fascinating. So in 1967, Computer Quiz was made. So just a year before, Nutting Associates was formed by Bill Nutting, and Computer Quiz is essentially a trivia game which displays a trivia question and players have to pick from multiple choice options. There were four subjects to choose from, including entertainment, sports, general knowledge, and people and places. What makes Computer Quiz so unique is that it actually used film reels to project the questions onto the machine. The Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, was able to preserve the film from Computer Quiz, and the machine still works as of September 3rd, 2021, when the Strong Museum posted a video going into the history of the game and the challenges of its preservation. I strongly recommend checking out the video about the preservation and history of Computer Quiz, as well as the museum. It's super fascinating stuff. I'm definitely going to go check out the museum if I'm ever in the Rochester area. It's awesome. It looks so cool. I definitely need to go see it. So, in 1968, Hammurabi is a text-based video game and was released on the PDP-8 computer. It was developed by Doug Diamond and simulates land and resource management. So think, if you had your grandmother that played Farmville, it's a lot like that. It's a lot like if Farmville had a grandparent. So, like, your grandparents' grandparent was playing Farmville if they were playing Hammurabi. Sorry, I just had a lot of flashbacks about Farmville. The game is about managing grain production in a city, and the player has to manage planting, consumption, and stocking silos. So this game also had hostiles and rats that would attack the grain supply. And I know this was text-based, but I would be really interested if they did, if I maybe I don't know, I didn't really research into if there is, but like if there's a remastered Hammurabi with like just it, I think it'd be kind of cool because it was completely text-based, so there was no images at all. And so I would be interested to see like a remaster, because I know they did one of the Oregon Trail, but they haven't done one of Hammurabi, at least I'm pretty sure. So, moving on, in 1969, Lunar Lander was created for the DEC PDP-8 mini computer by Jim Storer while a high school student at Lexington High School. Again, what is with these high school geniuses? I was just playing video games and watching, my varsity football team do okay. I mean, they weren't bad by any means, but they were okay. After Storer watched the Apollo 11 moon landing, he went on to create the game to simulate it. It was a text-based game, simulation game, and the plot of the game states that the onboard computer has failed on the lander and the player must land it manually. Players would need to set the burn rates of the retro rockets to successfully land. And this one also had a game over screen, and essentially it would tell you that you crashed and to try again. So, if you don't think that like Birdie the Brain's game over screen counts as the first game over screen, I would say this definitely fits. That 1969's Lunar Lander should hold the first game over screen if you don't think Birdie the Brain does. So there was another space game that was also launched in 1969 called Space Travel. And so this game was created by Ken Thompson and simulates traveling through the solar system by having players fly a spaceship on a two-dimensional scale model, and there were no objectives other than landing on planets and moons. So it kind of reminds me of if Space Engine had a grandparent as well. Again, also, I would definitely check out Space Engine. That's a great game. There were other games released in the early days of video games, including games like High Noon. This was another text-based adventure game, and it pitted the player in a shootout against the villain named Black Bart. There was also Weta or Awit, depending how you find it online. This was a chess game. There was not much else I could really find about it other than the fact that it was basically just chess. So eventually, though, the Juggernaut of the Oregon Trail was released. And that one I'm going to save for the next episode. As much as I would love to talk about the Oregon Trail, it definitely deserves its own dedicated episode just for how big it was. And so with that, though, that's going to conclude this episode of Memory Card. And this was a lot of fun research and work on. All of my sources are going to be cited in the description, and I highly encourage you to check out all of these sources to give them the love they deserve. I also highly encourage you go watch the docuseries of this episode on YouTube, on Gamma Galaxian on YouTube. That one's more clear, clean cut, more professional than the podcast versions. If this isn't really your cup of tea, I would definitely go check that out. I definitely take a lot more of a documentary professional style, other than kind of like this conversation kind of thing that I'm doing for the podcast. As for me, I'm just one guy with a passion for video games and history. If I have made any mistakes, please let me know. I would appreciate any feedback. But given the nature and timeline of video game history, I'm sure mistakes are going to happen. But regardless, though, I hope you found this interesting and you learned something. And thank you for listening, and I will see you next time. Hello everyone, welcome to this quick little outro. I had, after recording this episode, just realized that I have a pretty set character limit for the description of each episode, so I wanted to make sure I thanked my sources here, since I can't list them out in the description. It would be way too many. So I wanted to thank Britannica, The New York Times, Tektronix, historyofinformation.com, Popular Mechanics, Wired, LifeWire, Brookhaven National Laboratory, the Strong National Museum of Play, IMDb, Wikipedia, the Video Game History Project, the Video Game Historian, BBC, Computer History Museum, NASA, the National Archives, Computer Hope, IT History Society, Life Magazine, British Path, and there's some other sources that are listed in the YouTube version, since I used some videos from other YouTubers to showcase gameplay. So I did want to just thank everybody that I grabbed information from. This would not exist without all these sources. So definitely go check out all those sources. And if you want a complete list of sources, go check out the YouTube version. I'm not even going to beg you to watch, but just go check out the links. I have all the links to the specific articles and things like that. Just want to give these sources the credit that they're due. And that's going to do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. And if you would like, please go watch the YouTube version and definitely check out the sources. See ya.